This is only a game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Football is called the beautiful game by many of those who love it, at its most beautiful, especially when it's on the colossal stage of the World Cup or the Champions League final. It can be transcendent. Beyond that, it's fun for kids, it teaches teamwork and personal responsibility, and it can benefit communities. This has been true for hundreds of thousands of Kenyan kids who have played in a league that has raised up the neighborhoods in which they live. Dick Gordon has the story from Nairobi.
When you stand at the edge of the Mathari Valley and look down, all you see are waves of rusted tin. Once you're down in the slum, you realize each square of that metal is the roof for a home or a shop. The pathways between them are ditches filled with trash and human waste. They say that 500,000 people live here, but it could be as many as 700,000. Kenya's a country where kids can't go to school unless their parents pay fees. No education means no job, no chance at a future, and people get trapped in these slums. Makalati Anyango was the only girl in a family of brothers. She grew up in the Mathari slum.
I come from a family where we only survived on one meal a day. And it's not just a meal that you can count on. It was a very small meal that you can rely on. I was very tiny then. I was very small, simply because we didn't have enough to eat then. We did not have clothes. I remember I only had two clothes that time. So I could wear one and wash the other one, wait for the other one to dry and wash the other one.
The only way Makalati could earn any money was to search for rusty nails and other scraps of metal.
We used to go to a ditch where there is running sewage and water, and we put our hands inside. We try to look for the nails. If we get the nails and the metals, there's a place where you go sell them. They are weighed and you sell them and get some money out of it.
On a good day, she'd earn 20 shillings. That's equal to about 2 cents.
And once I get the 20 shillings, before my mom is back, because she also went to wash for other people's clothes so that she can get some money, then when she comes home, she finds that I've already prepared dinner.
And you were how old at that time?
I was very young. I was 9 years. I was 9 years.
30 years ago, Bob Monroe was also in that Mathari slum. Bob had already spent years working around the world on housing and development and environmental issues. In that summer of 1987, he spent his days in long meetings at the UN offices in Nairobi. When he got bored, he'd wander into the slum. One day, Bob was watching little kids, 4 or 5 years old, kicking a lumpy ball made of paper and string.
So I was standing there, and one of the kids kicked another kid, and the other kid was going to punch him or kick him back. But then he saw this white guy standing there who was watching, and I gave him the look, you know, and he didn't. But he found a way of sort of accidentally missing the ball and kicking him back a few minutes later. So I tweeted and said, "That's a foul, and we have to have a penalty kick." Now the kids got so excited that all of a sudden their game was official with a referee. And they were just so excited that they were going to have a penalty kick.
At that moment, Bob had an idea. He turned to a Kenyan friend and suggested setting up a small soccer league. Bob told the kids, "If you do something to support this league, I'll do something." He called it a tough love deal.
That was to protect me, huh? But it didn't. It turned out to be a big mistake, because I've been spending the last 30 years trying to hold up my end of the bargain, because they just kept doing things, expecting me, "Okay, we've done something, you do something."
Bob raised a bit of money and arranged to clear some land. Then he and a few of the kids went to a metal worker in the slum to get some goalposts.
So we agreed on the dimensions, and we used 2-inch pipes. And then we were about to move on, then one of the kids said, "Oh, don't forget, Bob, we have to drill a hole in the goalpost every foot or so around the goalpost." Right? Doesn't that make sense? "Bob, you don't understand. If we don't do that, people in the slum will steal them to use as water pipes." That's when I understood that they're the experts, and they should be making the decisions.
Once the league began to grow, FIFA got interested, and money started to come in from other donors. Much of it was used to help kids with their school fees. Makalati Anyango was still spending her time in the slum, helping feed her brothers. When she was 10 years old, she wandered down to the field where kids were playing soccer, and she met a young coach.
And then he asked me, "Where do you stay?" I said, "Just down here." And he also asked me, "Do you play football?" I said, "No." do you want to join football teams? I said, yes. Can you play football? I said, no. And then he asked me if I can come for the daily trainings in the evening.
At that point, Makalati had to say no, because she was still caring for her baby brother.
And I knew my mom is going to beat me if I bring the baby to the field. So the coach was very nice, and he told me, I will be passing by your home, because our home was just along the road to the field. I'll be passing by your home, and I'll be taking care of your baby while you train. But I had to make sure that I get home before my mom gets home.
She never knew that you were playing football?
She never knew that I was playing football. So at first I hid it from her, because the culture I come from is that we are not supposed to play football.
Girls
are not supposed to play. They think it has no use to participate in sports. There's no benefit. Because at that time, the benefit my parents wanted is money. So if you want to go do sports and sports is not giving you money, what's the point of doing sports?
The soccer league was known as MYSA, the initials MYSA, standing for the Mathare Youth Sports Association. In the league's second year, Bob had 21 teams.
And in December, we had a championships with real trophies and real referees out there, you know. And there's a picture of the commissioner of sport in the slum presenting a trophy, a good trophy, you know, a good-sized, healthy trophy, to a kid from the slum called Kingi, whose team had won. And that was in the newspaper the next day. That was stunning. There'd never been good news or positive news about it. It was always about drugs and prostitution and mob killings. And so 3 weeks later, when we opened up registration, and instead of 21 teams, we had 122 teams show up. And that's part of the secret of MYSA, is we could never say no. If a bunch of kids showed up, you know, barefoot, ripped shirt, torn pants, and said, we're a football team, could we join MYSA? You know, how can you say no? And so MYSA just started multiplying. And 10 years later, it was 1,000 teams, 1,200 teams, and today we're 1,800 teams.
1,800 teams?
25,000 players.
Just in Nairobi?
Just in the Mathare slums and the neighboring slums.
1,800 teams. And that's this year alone. You heard Bob say that part of the secret to MYSA is never saying no. But there's another secret. Remember I told you Bob worked for years on environmental issues. Like so many others trying to persuade politicians to do something, he kept coming up short. But Bob knew something the politicians didn't. He knew that the cleanliness and safety of the slums mattered to the people living there. So he said to the soccer players and their parents, if the kids want to play, they'll have to do some community service, some cleanup work.
The garbage is a killer. Okay? They live on slopes in Mathare Valley. And when the rains come twice a year, the rains are going through all that waste garbage that's not collected. Then the kids get sick, you know, typhoid, cholera, stuff we think of as from the Middle Ages. And they die. So we set that every team had to do at least 2 garbage cleanups a year. And we got wheelbarrows and rakes and shovels. They did it because for every football match they won, they got 3 points. For every garbage cleanup they did, they got 6. We're probably the only sports league in the world where the columns are games. 1, draw, lost, garbage, total points.
You wet your hands.
You wet your hands.
You take the soap.
You take the soap.
I went to see some of the youngest players practicing. And the rule on that day was this. If your team scores a goal, the other team has to do what they call the hand-washing chant.
You wash between your fingers.
You wash between your fingers.
There, the fingers.
Bob Monroe also insisted from the outset that it had to be the young people in charge, choosing the places in the slum to be cleaned, organizing practices and games. Think how different that is from most other countries where organized sports are all run by grown-ups, coaches, refs, hockey dads, soccer moms. Take Makalati Anyango, for example. She was a good soccer player. Then she became the first Kenyan woman to referee. Then she was reffing professional matches. Now she's a match commissioner. On the day we talked, we sat beside the field where the senior girls were practicing.
So we are here to work for the young people, for the young people. Because you'll find that MYSA is an organization that does not hire from outside. We don't employ you because we have degrees. We don't employ you because you are a son of a minister. We employ our people from the slums because they have the passion to do the job. It's giving back to their community. Somebody gave back to them. So it's their time now to give back. And they have a responsibility each to form a girls' team. Specifically a girls' team.
Each one of these players has to form a girls' team.
Each one of the players. Because by giving back to your community is making sure that you do what was done to you. And also, our conscience will not be clean if we don't mentor the young girls. Because that has been the tradition of this, the culture and tradition of this organization.
Not too long ago, Makalati Anyango was happy to earn 20 shillings, scavenging for scraps of metal. Now, that's all changed.
I moved my parents from Mathare. They are still in the slums, but they are not in Mathare slums. They're in a better place now. And we used to live in a mud house, they now live in a stone house. And life has really changed. And even today, when we sit with my family on a round table to talk, they can't believe that they are eating football, sleeping football, and their kids are going to school because of football. Up to today, for us, it's still a dream. And my dad even today asks me, this football thing, I didn't know that it can change somebody's life.
Some of these kids from the slums now play for professional teams in Europe. Others have become activists, musicians. One of them went on to become a Rhodes Scholar. And now it's these graduates, the alumni of MISA, who are helping support the organization financially. And everyone I talked to, they all said the same thing. They quote Bob Monroe. He's been telling them for years that one day the president of Kenya will be a kid from the Mathare slum, a kid who started out playing soccer with MISA. For Only a Game, I'm Dick Gordon.
In 1992, sharpshooter Craig Hodges was released by the Chicago Bulls, and no other team picked him up.
And everybody in the league knew it wasn't about my game.
An NBA champion and activist says he was blackballed for his political views. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Jasper O for leaving us the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. I love the offbeat stories. Where else could you hear about Punjabi hockey broadcasts that actually make you care about Punjabi hockey broadcasts? Thanks, Jasper O. I think maybe you can hear about Punjab hockey broadcasts in Punjab, which is a province of Canada. No, it's not. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's time for three stories you should know, and this week we're going to talk about concussions, sneakers, and sheriffs, or at least sheriff, or at least an aspiring sheriff. And this week we're in the studios of ESPN in Bristol, Connecticut. My guests are Bob Lee, longtime host of ESPN's Outside the Lines and now a co-host of ESPN's weekly show E60, and Jeremy Schapp, co-host and reporter for ESPN's E60. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be here.
A pleasure, sir.
I feel a little silly saying welcome to both of you since I'm in your studio.
Hope you enjoyed your time here.
It's been very nice.
That's great.
Jeremy, you go first.
Well, the concussion issue is the biggest issue on the landscape in sports, and it has been for a while now. And I think we're just at the beginning of finding out how this is going to affect participation in the collision sports, football, hockey, soccer, wrestling even, where there is head trauma. Obviously, auto racing is a factor. We can go on and on. There is so much at stake here in terms of viewership, quality of play. We are more disconnected than we have ever been in this country from, for instance, the sport of boxing. The question now is, to what extent is that going to happen? It's already happening to some extent, but how much further is it going to go in the collision sports with kids?
All right, Bob, Jeremy has posed the question. You get to be the first to try to answer it.
This is a serious issue, certainly medically. It's a public health issue. The pipeline question is essential for professional sports, but we see it trickling down to the high school levels in participation. We see it sometimes manifested in the interest, for example, and participation rates of high school football. you start to see the consolidation of different schools, other schools dropping the sport. And there's no doubt that over the last 10 years, parents are paying attention.
Let me throw this back to you, Jeremy, since it was your topic to begin with. What is the future of this game?
One thing I've learned, Bill, you know, working in this business for a while, predicting the future is very difficult. I mean, if you looked at the New York Times sports section or the Chicago Tribune sports section or the LA Times 60 years ago, what was it all about? It was all about baseball, college football, horse racing, and boxing. So nothing's at the top of the mountaintop forever. If you ask me, if I had to guess right now, is the NFL, is pro football going to remain at the very top of North American sports 30 years from now? I think this is an existential issue.
Bob, I know your topic is very different.
The mystique of the sneaker goes back to the Spike Lee commercials with Michael Jordan and the birth of the Nike brand. And onto the scene over the last several months, and our network has, some would say, might have been called an enabler here. You don't have to be that raucous, but LeVar Ball and his three sons, but principally LeVar, as a proponent of his son's excellence, of trying to package them as a deal for a proposed $1 billion sneaker proposition, and to put out his own brand of clothing, and now sneakers, a $495 shoe, a $220 sandal, and suggesting that Michael Jordan couldn't sell $495 shoes. Now, Ball is the perfect person for the media moment of 2017 because he knows he's human clickbait. He knows that TV shows want him. He's compelling. He's also the most American of figures. He's an entrepreneur. What distinguishes him from Phil Knight?
Except or Donald 40, Trump, for that matter.
Well, yes, except he doesn't have the nuclear codes yet. But, you know, except 40 years and a different postmark on his letters, that's the difference between LeVar Ball. There are some that are saying that this is the apocalypse come to life, and others that say, here's a guy establishing his brand. Yes, is he drawing attention away from his kids, but trying to get his piece of the pie. I vacillate myself whether I admire him for being brutally honest and seeing the world for what it is, which is this capitalist pie, and he's got the biggest knife out there cutting the biggest piece he can, or whether it is indeed the pillars of civilization are crumbling about us.
All right. Once again, Jeremy, Bob has set the table for you.
Well, Bill, you know, we're here in Bristol, Connecticut. We're probably only about 28, 29 miles from the city limits of Bridgeport, Connecticut. Of course, home to the birthplace of P.T. Barnum. In some ways, Mr. Ball is inheriting a very American mantle from Barnum. He is the guy at the center of the circus. He is drawing the attention to himself. He's saying, you know, come into the tent. See what my guys can do. See how outrageous we can be. You know, so I vacillate too on this, like Bob. Is this dangerous or is it harmless? Is it somewhere in between? I think I lean closer to the harmless. I think Mr. Ball has been inspired clearly by the words of the great Irish wit Oscar Wilde. Nothing succeeds like excess. And that has driven the pricing of the shoes. The whole point of making them $495, making them that expensive, $495 and $995, the whole point is to be expensive, to draw attention. And yet it's still the old marketing trick of putting it just below the round number. So it seems to be fighting itself. Shouldn't it be 500 and 1,000?
Your arguments are compelling. But there's still a little voice in the back of my head that's saying that this whole phenomenon is so utterly ridiculous and such a wild adventure in ego and tone-deaf publicity at this time in our lives.
You've described America.
That we should walk away from it. But we can't, I guess, because there it is.
Shaq has a sneaker. It sells for $30. But what is the lineage of LeVar Ball? It goes all the way back to Air Jordan. It is supremely American, and all the excess is we got what we deserved. And what we deserve is LeVar Ball on your phone, on your TV, on your radio, on your internet. And first day out, they sold $150,000 worth of shoes first day. Now, I don't know if that's a good number or a bad number, but it was a number. People were buying. Some people were buying.
All right. Once again, as is our custom on Three Stories, you should know we have saved the most important story.
All right. I'm ready for this now.
Shaquille O'Neal wants to be a sheriff. And his platform is very encouraging to me. His platform is he wants people to love and respect law enforcement officers. He's not sure where he's going to do it. He's a resident of Florida, but he's also a resident of Georgia. And he has experience as an honorary deputy in L.A., Miami, Tempe, Arizona, several other towns in Florida. It'd be very interesting to me to see the crime stats when Shaq is in office, wherever he happens to take office. Sheriff Shaq, I like it. I like the idea of his size 107 cowboy boots on the desk in the sheriff's office as he sits back in a creaky desk chair. It's irresistible to me. Would you vote for him?
Would I vote for Shaq? Well, I'm from New York. I know you guys are Jersey guys like Shaq, so you're inclined.
You're outvoted here, Shaq.
You're inclined to vote for him. You know, I don't think we have sheriffs in New York City. I know we have marshals, but they're job description is mostly seizing property. If it were a ceremonial thing, I like it, but I don't know if I want to place all of that power in the hands of someone with relatively little experience. I like Shaq. I've known him for a long time. I did a story about him when he was a rookie in the league. He's got a great sense of humor. He can laugh at himself. Those aren't necessarily the qualities you most want from a Wyatt Earp type.
Wyatt Earp. Wait a minute. No place has a sheriff like Wyatt Earp now.
Well, you know,
the dusty streets.
There is, you know, we can be nostalgic about these things.
That's
serious.
When I think sheriff, you know, I'm thinking John Ford and Wyatt Earp. I'll vote for him. What the heck?
Come back, Shane.
And what
all
about
of,
you, Bob?
All of that power in the hands of a guy who can't hit free throws, too.
That's true.
But you
that's,
know,
that's a good point.
There's no question where something like this.
Media is so negative.
A 7-foot-1 sheriff who could post up any bad guy. Now, Bill, it can't happen in Georgia. It has to happen in Florida. I mean, this is right out of a Dave Barry or Carl Hiaasen novel. You know, we've got an NBA pro basketball Hall of Famer, a 7-1 badass sheriff. And his name is Shaquille O'Neal. I endorse it heartily.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been ESPN's Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp, and they will be co-hosting a new weekly edition of E60, which airs Sunday mornings at 9 on ESPN. You can link to more information at onlyagame.org. Jeremy and Bob, what fun to have you on Three Stories You Should Know, and thank you very much for your hospitality here at ESPN.
Been great to have you here. Thank you so much.
I hope you check out the cafeteria before you leave.
It's primo.
The average length of an NBA career is 4.8 years. Craig Hodges, who began his pro career with the San Diego Clippers in 1982 and was released by the Chicago Bulls 10 years later, more than doubled that span, so he should be grateful, right? No, he figures he got a bum deal in 1992.
Man, at that point in time, man, nobody on earth shot the ball better than Craig Hodges. Nobody.
Maybe nobody on earth is an overstatement, but maybe not by much. Hodges twice led the NBA in three-point field goal percentage. He won consecutive three-point shooting contests during All-Star Weekend over the last 3 years of his career. He was a significant contributor to the Bulls' first two championships, and when he was released, he was only 32. Craig Hodges acknowledges that he wasn't a dependable defender, and Bulls head coach Phil Jackson was aware of it.
He said, hey, yeah, a lot of people in this league don't play defense, and none of them shoot as well as Craig.
It wasn't Coach Jackson who wanted Hodges gone. Hodges says it was Bulls general manager Jerry Krause who told him the team was going with younger players. He was disappointed, and though some former players have said he'd slowed down, Hodges figured lots of other teams could use a shooter. The phone never rang.
And everybody in the league knew it wasn't about my game. And so it's funny. At the same time, for me, it was a matter of $40 to $50 million that we could have made to change the condition of poor people.
Money for poor people? What does money for poor people have to do with the story of a shooter who feels he was blackballed by the NBA 25 years ago for reasons that had nothing to do with his talent? Hodges thinks we should look for the answer in his childhood.
Well, you know, for me, it all goes back to my mom. She's to me, When we think about Angela Davis, I had Angela Davis in my household.
Angela Davis is an activist who was associated with the Black Panthers in the 60s.
My mom was a freedom fighter early, and we were youngsters. And we had so many doors that we had to go knock on and get rid of your stack of petitions, and you were good. Because at that point in time, redlining was one of the main things that were going on in our community, and as well as voters' rights.
As he grew a little older, Craig Hodges began to understand that by sending him out to knock on doors, his mother was educating him. And as he began to excel at sports and identify himself as an athlete, he remembered her lessons.
When a teacher would give you the freedom to write about a topic, all the time my topics had a slant of somewhat politics and sport always interacting in some ways. So whether it was a baseball topic, I could talk about Curt Flood. If it was boxing, I could talk about Ali. If it was football, Jim Brown. If it was basketball, I could talk about Kareem.
Because Hodges identified with those activist athletes, it was not surprising that after he made it to the NBA with the Clippers in 1982, he became active in the Players' Union with a helpful shove from above.
Bill Walton, who's a Hall of Famer, took me under his wing probably our second day of meeting each other. And he told me, he said, I'm going to make you the player rep so that you'll always understand the importance of separating players from management. And that as long as you're in this game, man, make sure that you side with the players.
Hodges didn't limit his activism to the Players' Union. Various accounts characterize him as sensitive to the needs of his community when he was in the NBA. He's said to have preferred to do his charity work when the cameras weren't present. In 1988, having joined the Bulls, he says he tried to discuss Black history and social action with Michael Jordan.
He's a great businessman, and he understood that him taking a political stance could hamper his economics. And I'm not one to judge anybody on that, but I understand the importance of the economic tie to Nike, to the Black community, to young men, to death, to murder of people who are killing people over your gym shoe and the like. So to me, when we're talking on issues concerning our history, you weren't astute.
Hodges wanted Jordan to leave Nike and create a company that would provide jobs in sneaker production and sales to folks in Chicago. Before Game 1 of the NBA Finals between the Bulls and the Lakers, he suggested that the teams might just slightly change the world by refusing to take the floor. He says Michael Jordan told him he was crazy, and Magic Johnson said, "That's too extreme, man." He felt like a minority of one. After the Bulls won the 1992 NBA title, they visited George H.W. Bush at the White House. Craig Hodges was the only Bull in a dashiki. He brought a letter for President Bush urging him to address the concerns of poor and minority communities.
You know, I'm not coming with my hat in my hand. I'm just saying, man, take a serious, critical look because you the man. And you being the man, I think I need to share this with what I had to say at this point in my life. So here it is, brother, and hope you get a chance to read it.
Shortly after he visited the White House as a champion, Craig Hodges was released. He feels being blackballed was the price he paid for his politics and perhaps for needling the superstars. Life after the NBA was grim. For a time, Hodges battled what he believed was an organized effort to keep him out of basketball. He filed a lawsuit that was dismissed by a judge who said he'd waited too long to file it. He struggled to provide for his children. He sold his rings and trophies. He doubted his own worth, and he starred in a cautionary tale. Eitan Thomas, a former center for the Washington Wizards, says that when he spoke out against the second war with Iraq, other players told him, "You don't want to be like Craig Hodges." Eventually, Hodges found his way back to basketball. He worked with the Lakers as one of Phil Jackson's assistants from 2005 until 2011. Today, he's coaching at his alma mater, Rich East High School in Park Forest, Illinois, urging his players to accept some of the ideas that his teammates in the NBA ignored.
There's a song that I think it's Ice Cube he has, and it says, "The road to freedom is seldom traveled by the multitude." And that's real, man, that when we look at the mission that we on and we speak truth to power, we speak for the ills of those who can't speak for themselves, that's not a whole lot of folks because it's not profitable. The money side of things is what people scrambling to get to. People not scrambling on this side.
The most fortunate athletes have a say in when their careers end. Craig Hodges didn't, and that still bothers him. He feels as if he was forced to leave on the table money with which he could have done a lot of good. That's evident when he talks about his most recent project, a book about his career and its premature end. Though his income has declined, his focus hasn't changed.
All the models that we need and the examples that we need have been set for us. Dr. King set the examples. Malcolm set the examples. So we have to pick up the legacy of those leaders that, and mentors that have put great lessons in front of us that work.
Craig Hodges' new book is Long Shot, The Triumphs and Struggles of an NBA Freedom Fighter. You can link to it at onlyagame.org. Before the start of her eighth WNBA season, Allison Feaster learned she was pregnant.
I was ecstatic, but at the same time, you have to really consider the professional ramifications. I thought about my teammates. How was I going to play?
Life as a pro athlete and a mom, that's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar discusses his long friendship and his differences with UCLA coaching great John Wooden. But first, Charlie Pierce and I will discuss this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
The San Antonio Spurs and the Golden State Warriors are in the Western Conference Finals. Is this an intriguing matchup, or are the Spurs doomed?
No, I think the Spurs and the Warriors is the matchup people wanted to see. The Spurs handled Houston incredibly easily, especially in the last game where they were missing practically everybody on their roster going back to George Gervin. I think the Warriors will win. I think they'll probably win in four or five games, but I think the games will be very entertaining.
Spurs star guard Tony Parker is out for the rest of the playoffs. He's injured. But San Antonio has overcome so many different kinds of injuries, departures, everything else. What about when Parker, Manu Ginobili, and coach Greg Popovich all move on?
Well, I think as long as Popovich stays there, he'll find something. They found Kawhi Leonard, after all, who may be one of the two or three best players, not maybe, is one of the two or three best players in the league. I think they'll find a way to do it as long as Popovich stays. If he decides that he's had a lovely run and it's time to go to the beach, I don't blame him.
Golden State Warriors forward Kevin Durant said this week that the NBA Combine is a waste of time for top college players. I can't quote him exactly because we're on the radio, but I guess he should know.
Yeah, at the level Kevin Durant was, when you're talking about the top four or five players in the draft, it is kind of a waste of time. Everybody knows what they can do. And we found out this week that some NBA goon asked Frank Mason III from Kansas how he wanted to die. That was supposed to give him some sort of insight into how he can play in the NBA. I have no idea what it is, but what I do know is that NBA assistant coaches should never take psychology classes.
Charles Barkley had a long and lucrative career in the NBA, of course. He's a TV analyst these days, and this week he said that today's NBA is the worst it's ever been. I wonder if he was watching in the mid-70s.
That's exactly my point. I mean, I remember the days when the NBA Championship Series was on delayed broadcast. So Charles is running his mouth again, and that's too bad. But he does like the NHL. We got to give him points for that.
Yeah, he said, thank God for the NHL playoffs. I guess he's backstage on the TV set watching hockey games.
Watching Edmonton. In Anaheim.
The hockey season is over for the Washington Capitals, courtesy of the Penguins. Charlie, is this a story from last May that somehow got stuck in this week's pile, or is it still current?
This is just amazing. I mean, this is every year now with a really good team with one of the two or three best players in the league and a really good goaltender, and they can't beat one other team. And this time, not even with an injured Sidney Crosby, but with Marc-Andre Fleury playing like Patrick Roy.
This one of the best players to whom you referred is, of course, Alex Ovechkin. Some people are saying the Capitals ought to trade him. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we find out now he played through the whole series with an injury. So, I mean, I think at some point the Caps are going to have to think seriously about busting this group up because unless they can arrange for Pittsburgh not to make the playoffs some year, they've got huge trouble.
All right, quiz time. You ready for this?
Got it.
Name the most recent NHL team to have lost a game by 6 goals and won a playoff series anyway. And I'll give you a hint. No team named after this particular animal should ever win anything.
That would have to be the Anaheim Ducks, which are no longer the Mighty Ducks. But, yeah, they put the kibosh on Connor McDavid and the Oilers. I don't think the Oilers are ready to play a seventh game, to be honest with you.
Actually, I mentioned that about Ducks. I'm not sure a team named after a penguin should win anything.
Well, you're stuck there, I'm afraid, because of all those Stanley Cups.
They keep doing it. FIFA president. I hardly get the sentence out. Anyway, FIFA president Gianni Infantino said this week that FIFA had been the victim of, quote, fake news, and that soccer's governing body was, quote, transforming itself. I don't even think I need to ask a question here.
Well, no, I just think that, you know, many federal witnesses transform themselves and wind up working in a Kmart in Idaho.
Driving inconspicuous cars.
What exactly was fake about the FIFA thing? All those fake indictments or all that fake money laundering?
FC Barcelona announced this week that it will own a National Women's Soccer League team beginning in 2018, possibly in L.A., possibly in San Jose or Atlanta. This should be interesting.
Yes, and you'll have another team to root for.
Absolutely. Maybe the heroes will visit from time to time.
Uh-huh.
Here's a recent quote from a 13-year-old soccer player in Spain. Her name is Andrea Gomez, and she said, "I always try to show that soccer isn't just for boys." And I'd say she's found a pretty good way to show that. Not only does she score a lot of goals, but she led her team, an all-girls team, to a championship in an all-boys league.
This girl scored 38 goals this year.
Yeah.
So apparently she's very talented. Maybe she'll come over and play for FC Barcelona's team in San Antonio or around.
It's probably inevitable. Tony Romo said this week that he expects to stink for a while in his new job on TV. I thought playing sports was supposed to build your confidence.
Well, no, I don't care who you are and what you've done. If you're behind a microphone that's broadcasting to however many million people and you're supposed to say something smart, I think anybody would freeze up.
So you're okay with him saying, "I'm going to stink for a while"? You know,
yeah, well, as long as he's preparing us, I don't have a problem with it.
Okay. Finally, Charlie, we have a story of President Trump's importance to lacrosse, or at least to one college lacrosse team. The Adelphi University team has replaced its warm-up music with a tape of a Trump speech, and the team finished the regular season 14-3, so I don't know if they're tired of winning.
I was about to say, aren't you getting tired of all this winning?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated from time to time, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Have you subscribed to Only a Game yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss an episode. Go to iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's not unusual for female pro athletes to have kids. This Mother's Day weekend, we're going to focus on one basketball player who balanced motherhood with competition while navigating some complicated geography. WBUR's Shira Springer has the story.
I was at Valenciennes, France for 4 seasons. After the Sparks, I went to the Charlotte Sting for 6 summers. In those off seasons, I was in, this is a long list, excuse me, I was in Valencia, Spain. I was in León, Spain.
This is what happens when I ask Allison Feaster to recount all the stops in her professional basketball career. There are 2 continents, 5 countries, and 12 cities to cover.
3 years in Alcobendas, which is a suburb of Madrid, Spain, and that was my last team.
Did you ever think that you'd play professional basketball for as long as you did? I mean, it was, what, an 18? Am I counting? Can I count right?
Yeah.
It's an 18-year career?
It was an 18-year career. No, I did not think I would be playing professional basketball at all and for so long.
As a Harvard senior, Feaster led the nation in scoring, but...
Because you're coming from the Ivy League, it's like, you know, those numbers don't matter. Those results don't matter.
She thought her basketball career would end after college.
I had a job offer to be an equities analyst at Merrill Lynch on Wall Street, and just so happens that this job offer coincided with, I guess, one of the most important games in collegiate basketball history, at least for the Harvard folks.
It was 1998. The Harvard women's basketball team was a number 16 seed in the NCAA tournament. Stanford was a number 1 seed. They met in the first round, and the game was nationally televised.
Feaster trying another three, and this one she nails. Her 53rd three-pointer of the year. Feed inside for the left-hand runner by Feaster, and it's a four-point lead. Inside, it's Feaster, right past Pruitt. A terrific setup.
For the first and only time in NCAA tournament history, a number 16 seed upset a number 1 seed. And Feaster dominated, finishing with 35 points, 13 rebounds, and 3 steals in 39 minutes.
That played a huge part in just me being respected as a player. I got a little bit of exposure and was able to be drafted into the WNBA and decided to pursue a professional playing career instead of going to work on Wall Street.
Fast forward 7 years. Feaster is married to her high school sweetheart, Danny Strong, and she is playing summers in the WNBA and winters overseas. Women typically play year-round to make a living.
I just finished a season in France. We just won the French title, and as customary, I would get on a plane the next day or two after the last game and report to my WNBA team. When you arrive in your WNBA city, which was Charlotte at the time, you have to go have a physical. And in my physical, the doctor confirmed that I was a few weeks pregnant. I was ecstatic. We were ecstatic. But at the same time, you have to really consider the professional ramifications of being pregnant. You know, how am I going to, manage this pregnancy, continue to play for how long? Where will I give birth? Which continent? I would have to stop playing in Europe for a season. It was my livelihood. So it was a mixture of excitement coupled with uncertainty. The doctors immediately said, you can continue with your lifestyle that you maintained before the pregnancy. And I really took that and ran with it.
So she played almost the entire WNBA season, staying in the lineup as a starter until she was 4 months pregnant. It wasn't until Feaster began cutting her compression shorts to make them fit that she considered taking maternity leave. After the WNBA season, she joined her husband in Europe. On February 2, 2006, Feaster went to the gym as usual for a workout. The next morning, her daughter, Sarah Elise Strong, was born in a suburb of Madrid, where her husband was playing basketball. It wasn't long before Feaster was back to training for her next WNBA season.
And was there any, pressure to keep playing? Just concerns about keeping your job, keeping your place in the rotation, whatever that may be?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think if you're an elite-level athlete, I think there is always pressure to, not miss out, to not take a break, to play through the pain. And I think that's one of the reasons why I rushed back from pregnancy, because it's your livelihood, and the moment you are not around, it's a lot easier to be forgotten. I do remember my first game back. It was against, I think it was the Indiana Fever, and my knee was killing me, and I had no lift. I could barely jump, and I started the game, but I didn't play much the remainder of the game. And I remember trying to, in my head, this was probably a good idea, but at the time, it was awful. I was going to take a three-point shot with Tamika Catchings, who was one of the most athletic, dynamic, one of the best players to ever play the game. But I decided to take a three-point shot with her, maybe an arm's length or two arms' length away. And, she stuffed it. She made me eat it. That was kind of the epitome of, you're not ready to play.
It's kind of a cruel welcome back.
It was, but, sports are filled with those moments.
Despite a rough return to pro ball, Feaster decided to play year-round and headed to Europe after the WNBA season. That meant moving overseas with Sarah in tow. And for Feaster, as one half of a couple with two professional basketball players, bigger challenges were coming. Travel, language barriers, time apart from her husband, who often played on different teams in different countries.
My husband is pretty practical, and he understands the role that a mother plays in a young child's life especially. And it was just an unspoken, she'll stay with me when we have to be apart.
Danny retired from playing in 2011, moved back to the U.S., and started a new career as a high school coach. Feaster continued competing in Europe and says,
it got more complicated once Sarah began to grow a bit older.
By then, Feaster was in her mid-30s and no longer commanded a high salary, and the end of her playing career was not too far away. Knowing that, Feaster had some difficult conversations with her husband.
He's getting antsy, saying, okay, we're going to have to look at some other options. My salary decreased, I guess, a few years after playing at the highest level, so it became, okay, so what are you going to do now? You're not making as much money. You should probably think about doing something else. I want you guys to come home. But I always saw Europe, or my time in Europe, as so much more than just earning money. I saw it as an education.
For her daughter as well.
Obviously, Europe is multicultural. It made sense to me. I wanted to give her that life. I wanted to give her that experience.
Feaster played in Europe for 10 seasons while also raising Sarah. Most of that decade was spent in Spain, and she says Sarah is a Spaniard at heart.
My daughter, who is bilingual, will often chide me for not speaking with the lisp when I say the letters C and Z in Spanish words.
Feaster's last stop was a club near Madrid. While they made a home there, her daughter joined the youth team sponsored by Feaster's club. It was the first time Sarah played organized basketball, and she reminded some of her mother.
Her coach referred to her as Mini Feaster or Feaster. She is a much more skilled ball handler. Like, even in late in my career, I wasn't that great handling the ball. I could shoot, I could play defense and rebound, but she's much more skilled in that respect. She is capable of making passes that I would never, ever have made in my career. It was an interesting and cool moment for me to be able to go to practice and see her at the gym practicing, or have her and her teammates come and watch my practice, or her teammates come to my games, or my teammates go to her games. It made playing for me that much more special.
Last year, Feaster retired from playing. Sarah was 10. Now they're all living together in North Carolina.
We had to compromise a lot, and it was a lot of back and forth. Looking now at our daughter after having had that exposure, I think we're both very thankful that we made those decisions at the time.
Also last year, Sarah tagged along to one of her mother's speaking engagements. Feaster was talking to a young team, mostly 16 and 17-year-olds, and she showed some highlights of the Harvard-Stanford game.
I think at that moment it began to dawn on her that, hey, okay, this is what this is all about. What's funny is I'll go to parent-teacher conferences and the teacher will say, hey, we Googled you in class. I'm like, oh my gosh, why? So my daughter obviously is proud of me, even though I don't hear about it from her directly.
Feaster now works in the NBA. She's part of a program that encourages former NBA and WNBA players to explore other sides of professional basketball. And she's got a world of experience to share. For Only a Game, I'm Shira Springer.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Allison Feaster, who likens her experiences in Europe to those of a famous naturalist.
I think back to Henry David Thoreau. Don't want to sound like a nerd, but simplicity is one of the greatest things I learned in Europe.
Actually, playing basketball all over the world while raising a child doesn't sound at all simple. All Henry had to do was tend his bean patch and write in his journal. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.